I'm Nick Mason. I play drums in Pink Floyd. You're listening to A History of Music and Technology. From the advent of sound recordings to the explosive noise of the electric guitar, to the electronic age of synths and drum machines, across this series we've witnessed how music has been fundamentally transformed by technology. But now, in the final episode of this series, we're asking, what does the future hold for music? We'll find out what the studios of tomorrow might look like, why the phones in our pockets are giving traditional instruments a run for their money, and just how can a young musician starting out today make a living from their craft in the age of streaming. But to look to the future, first we need to go back in time to the turn of the millennium, to an interview David Bowie gave the BBC in 1999. This is an interview in which Bowie predicted that the internet would upend everything, in particular music.
It was very hard to hear music when I was younger. When I was really young, you had to tune into AFN radio to hear the American records. But there was no MTV, and there wasn't sort of wall-to-wall blanket music. So therefore, it had a kind of a call-to-arms kind of feeling to it. This is the thing that will change things. This is dead dodgy occupation to have. Now it's a career opportunity. And the internet carries the flag of being subversive and possibly rebellious and chaotic, nihilistic, and so I find that terribly exciting.
You don't think that some of the claims being made for it are hugely exaggerated?
No, you see, I don't agree. I think the internet, I don't think we've even seen the tip of the iceberg. I think the potential of what the internet is going to do to society, both good and bad, is unimaginable. I think we're actually on the cusp of something exhilarating and terrifying.
It's just a tool, though, isn't it?
No, it's not. No, it's an alien life form. It's their life on Mars. Yes, it's just landed here.
Within a matter of weeks of this interview, two young Americans called Sean Fanning and Sean Parker launched a file-sharing service called Napster, which would lay a bomb underneath the entire music industry.
Something dangerous lurks inside a PC near you. It's called Napster.
The internet, frantically swapping music files, bypasses the CD altogether.
This is a revolution in that, obviously, what it does is it gives you access to all the music ever created whenever you want it.
The CD's days are numbered.
The CD is dead.
In April of 2000, the heavy metal band Metallica, led by drummer Lars Ulrich, sued Fanning and Parker for illegally distributing its music for free, eventually leading to Napster going bankrupt.
It's not really about us at the end of the day. What it is about, it's taking a stance, and I think who it mostly affects are really the people in the smaller bands. They depend on the royalties, they depend on their publishing income.
Just over a year later, the CEO of Apple, Steve Jobs, took to the stage at a low-key event at the company's headquarters in California to unveil a small white box.
iPod is the size of a deck of cards. A deck of cards. And this is what the front of it looks like. Boom. That's iPod. I happen to have one right here in my pocket, matter of fact. There it is, right there.
The iPod was sold with the tagline,
iPod, 1,000 songs in your pocket.
This portable jukebox was about to change the way we interacted with our music collections for good. And now consumers could fill their iPods with MP3s purchased from the recently launched online iTunes store. But music piracy continued to thrive, and with new Napsters such as LimeWire and BitTorrent coming online, the music industry was in freefall. But soon, help was on its way, thanks to a group of Swedish techies who launched this in 2006.
Spotify is an online music service which gives users access to more than 4 million tracks for nothing if they listen to an advert every 20 minutes.
Streaming had arrived, and along with it, a business model the industry hoped would stamp out illegal file sharing.
But why are the big record companies prepared to deal with the likes of Spotify? As one executive explained over the internet from Los Angeles, it's all about fighting web piracy.
The consumers are already familiar with not paying for their music when they download it off the internet. So we have to do more and more interesting deals to make them listen to music in a legitimate format.
And then in 2007, Steve Jobs stood up in a much bigger hall than he did when he launched his iPod and announced this.
A phone. And an internet communicator. An iPod. A phone.
With the arrival of smartphones and 4G networks, we no longer carry just 1,000 songs in our pocket, but millions. And within the space of only 10 years, the internet, much as David Bowie predicted in 1999, completely disrupted the music industry. But as you'll hear over the next hour, rapid technological developments aren't just altering our listening habits. They're also changing the way we make and interact with music. For centuries, a musical instrument could only perform the task which it was designed and built for. A flute could not be turned into a guitar. But in the digital age, many are harnessing the powers of the modern-day smartphone to create their own musical instruments. Ger Wang is a professor of music and computer science at Stanford University, and author of Artful Design, Technology in the Search of the Sublime. Ger is also the inventor of one of the first mobile musical instruments, an app he calls Ocarina.
It basically transforms your phone into a flute-like instrument. You play the ocarina by blowing into the microphone at the bottom of your phone, and you're using multi-touch to control pitch, while accelerometer and the tilt of your phone is mapped to vibrato. If you like, I can play a little for you. So here's Ocarina. Yeah, there I'm using my fingers to change the pitch. Now that's the instrument part of Ocarina. Another part of the app, you can actually see a globe visualization of the world and listen to other people blowing to their phones around the world. Here is Germ from Chicago, who appears to be playing the Legend of Zelda theme song. And we can kind of surf. Oh, here's someone from France. So, yeah, this is Ocarina. It's a place where you can blow into the phone, express yourself. I like to think there's a little sense of connection you feel to the rest of the world.
Someone else who has been at the vanguard of generating sounds with the phone is the pioneer of ambient music, Brian Eno. Along with the software designer Peter Chivers, he has created a series of apps, including Bloom, now in its 10th edition, which allows anyone to create unique melodies by simply tapping the screen. Here's Peter and Brian explaining how it works. Peter first.
It's a very simple process. You tap on the screen, and where you tap, it's a circle expands a bit like a ripple in a pond, and that releases a sort of bell-like sound. And then that repeats again. And it doesn't sound like much, but you play a few notes, and they all start repeating, you get a quite hypnotic pattern. And it just evolves, it constantly recombines. And that's something that sort of comes largely out of Brian's historical work with ambient and generative music.
I love making sounds. That's what I do on trains. I sit there with my computer building new little software instruments, basically little synthesizers, but I don't write the code. I take software that exists and do new things with it. We were also thinking, of course, about what kinds of sounds are going to work on a phone as opposed to a big set of hi-fi speakers. You know, the limitations of the medium dictated to some extent what we chose to work with.
Perhaps tapping or blowing into your phone to generate music just isn't for you. But what if there was a way to use your mobile to manipulate your favourite track on demand? Justin Patterson is a professor of music technology at the University of West London and the co-creator of an app called VariPlay. Developed with Warner Music, it allows listeners to do just that.
I've got my phone in front of me, and here is the latest app, and it's a French band called Offenbach, who are a DJ duo. Offenbach have a single out called Rocket, and we have an interactive version of the track on my phone. And I'm able to do things with the phone and make the track sound a little bit different every time we play it. So here, if I actually try it on my phone, we're now able to hear a particular version of the song. And if I press a different button, I'm going to press it now. beat has come in. I'll press a different button. Or a different button. And what the app can do is it can cherry pick from a palette, if you like, of audio, just as a producer might in a recording studio when they're sitting there at the big mixing desk. And it depends on what raw material the artist and producer have given the thing to populate it. Here's an opportunity. If the artist has a broader creative vision than that just stereo track, then they can now deliver it to the consumer, and the consumer can have an enhanced experience by hearing more of what the artist is about.
But what if you wanted to manipulate a song which had been produced back in the days of analog recording, where all you have to work with is a mastered stereo track? Say, for example, that your favourite song was Heard It Through the Grapevine. But instead of listening to the song in all its glory, perhaps you fancied honing in on, say, Marvin Gaye's mellifluous voice. It took me by surprise, I must say, when I found out yesterday. Don't you know that I heard it through the grapevine? This is an emerging area of audio processing, known as repurposing, where the hope is that one day we'll be able to extract all the components that make up a mixed stereo track. Using machine learning and sophisticated algorithms, soon we'll all be able to play it being the master sound engineer, remixing and mashing up our favourite songs.
At the moment, these tools are very much kind of in the research lab. There's a few just starting to emerge commercially, don't sound that great. They're great enough to be used for certain things. For instance, if you want that vocal just to be a bit louder in the stereo baked track, if you like, we can isolate the vocal enough to just make it a little bit louder. But if you were to actually take it out and try and use it in a different track, there's probably going to be artifacts. But repurposing has all kinds of connotation. So for instance, if you are listening to a song by Madonna and actually you wish that Madonna sounded a bit more like Aretha Franklin, then you'll be able to press the Aretha Franklin button. Perhaps a more real-world version of that would be if I were to sing and I wished I sounded like Aretha Franklin, I'd be able to push the Aretha Franklin button on myself. And that would democratise high-quality music production, sort of in line with digital photography, where everyone's got a fancy camera on their phone now, and more people are taking a lot of photos. But actually, the nature, the technical quality of those photographs are all driven by algorithms. The same is very likely to happen to music, where more and more people will be able to make higher quality music, but that music will be controlled and constrained, I think, by the algorithms that people use.
I'm not sure how I feel about someone tinkering with all the Pink Floyd drum parts by just tapping a few buttons on their phone. But then in the future, maybe the idea of sitting behind a set of drums on a stage will also be an alien concept. In fact, a future concert could just be a musician creating sounds through gestures, using what's called wearable music technology. Musician Imogen Heap has been at the forefront of this movement, developing a glove she's called the Mimu, to be released commercially later this year. The gloves allow Imogen to create and manipulate sounds on stage by the movement of her hands. Taking a break from touring the USA, Imogen explained where the idea came from.
It came from a kind of desperation and frustration about being on stage and being barricaded by equipment and weighed down by the equipment, when actually what I wanted to do was something very simple. I just wanted to record, I wanted to move sound around the room. So the idea that actually we could kind of access all the technology within the laptop or within the computer, but without having to touch it and without having to have all these external boxes touring around, I have so little gear. But actually most of the heaviness of the weight is the packs, is the radio packs for my headset and for my in-ears. I'm just like this light, freed being on stage in my own head. It just feels like this, you know, orchestra of sound that's coming from my fingertips.
But how exactly do the gloves work? Adam Stark is managing director of Mimu.
Yeah, so I'm just turning the gloves on now, and I'm going to switch into a mode where I can do something. So basically, I'm going to make a fist with my right hand, and that's going to play a chord. So. And if I now point my hand up in a different direction, I get a different chord. Or out, if I'm now putting my hand out to the side, and then down to the bottom. And now if I roll my left wrist, I have sensitive control over the brightness of the sound. So I'm rolling my left wrist from left to right. And then when I let go again, the chord will stop. So I have another mode here where I've now got an individual sound on each finger. What I can do is I can play these sounds and then I can feed them into an infinite reverb by rolling my wrist to the left. So this is now sustaining these sounds like basically forever. Now if I make a one finger point with my right hand and then move it out to the right hand side, you can hear now that it's controlling this other effect, which is bringing these kind of crystal sounds, which as I bring my hand back and forth, it becomes very expressive. And then as I bring it back to the pointing straight in front of me, then it becomes dull again, and then I can open my hands.
I'm also not just accessing different sounds from inside my computer and changing those, I'm also very much augmenting my voice. And for the audience, that's the real thing that they just love, because you understand the human voice is something that you can't deny, and you know instantly when it's being messed with. So when you change the voice, that's when the audience really, really get it. And as technology grows with us, the software side of it, then as software decides, okay, we're going to think in gestural terms instead of in linear terms, instead of on and off and, you know, up and down, but we start to think in terms of human form and human movement, then we can really start to progress and just create music that we could never have imagined right now.
Another individual redefining the possibilities of a live concert experience thanks to technology is Professor Ge Wang, who in 2008 started the Stanford Laptop Orchestra. Instead of attending a traditional concert with an orchestra made up of a string section, a brass section, and so forth, an audience sits down in front of a bank of 20 laptops, along with human performers.
We've had more than 250 pieces now in the Stanford Laptop Orchestra. They're all different from one another. We've had pieces in which we've basically had an imaginary battle between wizards and archers, where the sound is what's flying across the orchestra. And people are using sensors that tracks your arm, so it looks like you're pulling back a bow to shoot an arrow, except there is no actual arrow, but there's a sonic arrow that you hear flying across the orchestra. Meanwhile, a dragon in the back of the stage is another performer, they would be flapping their arms, and the way their arms are flapping translates into kind of these thunderous sounds of wind. In another piece, we might be very calmly listening to kind of a serene performance of a gamelan orchestra. It can sound like a drum circle. And so basically, it really runs the gamut in terms of what you would expect to see. And every piece is quite different.
Today, even a laptop orchestra has a human element to it. But in the future, will we see stadiums filled with people cheering and singing along, not to us mere mortals, but to avatars and AI-generated pop stars? Believe it or not, but this phenomenon is already here thanks to the Japanese pop sensation Hatsune Miku.
Hatsune means the first sound, and Miku can be written like Japanese word for the future.
This is Guillaume Devine from Krypton Future Media. His company created the virtual character of Miku, a manga-inspired 16-year-old girl with neon blue hair and bright blue eyes. Behind the avatar is a piece of technology known as a Vocaloid, essentially a voice synthesizer. And Miku has sold out concerts from Tokyo to LA and has even opened for Lady Gaga.
Technically, the concert, you have Hatsune Miku, who's like a 3D rendering on a big transparent screen. That makes it look like she's actually on stage, because you can see behind her. So you have that sense of depth that creates the illusion. And then also, she always plays with a live band. So you have four or five musicians The fans know the songs really well. The songs are on the internet. The songs are used in video games, even if it's 99% Japanese songs. We did that concert in London last year, and many of the fans there would sing along in Japanese.
One reason why the fans know Miko so well is they are responsible for creating much of her content. Thanks to social media and by using the Vocaloid, fans have uploaded over 100,000 songs and created over 1 million artworks.
She's like a blank canvas. Very little we say about her. She just has that picture of her. We set an age, then people are free to do whatever they want with her. And it kind of snowballed into that huge, like, kind of creative movement. Young artists, some of them actually became quite famous. They have a career of their own, even without Hatsune Miku, but as professional singers or musicians.
But perhaps a 3D animation of a teenage Japanese cartoon isn't your thing. Maybe you'd rather see your favorite singer, even if they'd died 30 years ago. Well, technology can help here too. Justin Patterson again.
I am the proud possessor of a ticket to see Frank Zappa in a couple of months. He died about 30 years ago, but he's got a hologram. There's going to be a live band and a hologram of Frank Zappa. Presumably they have extracted his vocal and guitar performances from some multi-track tapes, and the band is going to play along with a backing track that synchronizes, and we will see a hologram of Frank. I don't entirely know what to expect, but we're going to get more and more of this. I can foresee the day that we will have live bands which are a bunch of holograms, which are not at all translucent. They look like they're solid beings. They're going to be reacting to the audience, to each other, and these guys will be projected into your living room as 3D entities. And there we're starting to go into the whole world of augmented reality or mixed reality. We're certainly going to have a very mixed reality world probably in about 10 years. We'll all be engaging with this. These possibilities are not very far away.
Good morning.
Coming up after the news, the impact of artificial intelligence on music.
Welcome to the revolution.
She was able to create fully orchestral pieces of music that were in her vision in a matter of minutes or hours, depending on how long she wanted to work on it, that ultimately fueled her success.
Plus, the problems of too much technology.
New musicians are kind of overloaded by influences. They've heard everything. They've heard too much. The temptation, I think, is that they make these sort of eclectic mosaics out of things from the past, and they don't have that sort of drive to do new things.
Welcome to the new world.
That's all coming up after the news.
Welcome to the new world.
Welcome to the future. Future.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Mason from Pink Floyd. Welcome back to A History of Music and Technology. This week, we are asking, what does the future hold for music? In the first half, you heard from musicians and programmers who are using the smartphone to help generate new sounds. And we heard how technology is changing the live experience. Plus, we started the documentary with David Bowie skillfully predicting in 1999 how much the internet would disrupt every aspect of the music industry.
Just walking the day.
Today, we are only beginning to see how the rapid growth of artificial intelligence has the potential to upend many industries, including music.
Where are we now?
And once again, it was Bowie who was leading the way in experimenting with early forms of AI to assist with his songwriting process. In the 1990s, he developed a piece of software called the Verbosizer, which helped David generate lyrics for his album, Outside.
It'll take the sentence and I'll divide it up between the columns. And then when I've got, say, three or four or five, sometimes I go as much as 20, 25 different sentences going across here. And then I'll set it to randomize. And it'll take those 20 sentences and cut in between them all the time, picking out, choosing different words from different columns and from different rows of sentences. So what you end up with is a real kaleidoscope of meanings and topics and nouns and verbs, all sort of slamming into each other.
Tears upon
David Bowie in Michael Apted's 1997 documentary, Inspirations. But in a little over 20 years, AI has progressed so far that this is a piece of music which was composed this year, not by a human, but by a machine learning algorithm. And it was created by a company called Amper Music. Amper are just one of a number of players in the AI music game. Google, Spotify, IBM, Sony, all are investing heavily in this nascent industry. But how exactly does AI music work? Drew Silverstein is CEO and co-founder of Amper Music.
When someone is using Amper, they are asking for music using adjectives, using genre, using mood, using style, emotion, to request what the music should be. And it's Amper's job to say, if someone wants to feel this emotion, what does Amper need to create musically to make sure that happens? And to do that, there's a handful of steps. The first is we've got to write, in essence, the sheet music of the final piece of music. And then the next step is to turn that static piece of sheet music into audio. And so to do that, we rely on our proprietary sample library. And we have a recording studio where we record every note of every instrument thousands and thousands of times to capture every possible way you would ever play the instrument at the most finite level. So if you think of a violin, right, we're playing on the G string, and then we're going to play with 20 different articulations, different velocities, different timbres, every possible thing we can think of. And in fact, we now have one of the world's largest sample libraries. And so we take the, we'll call it sheet music that Amper's created, turn that over to our performance system, so to speak, and have Amper stitch together thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of audio files to create a performance of the music that should sound like a seamless recording out of a studio. And all of this happens from the time someone might ask for Amper to create a piece of music to the time we're able to deliver that piece of music in a matter of seconds.
Good morning.
It's early days for this cutting-edge technology.
Welcome to the revolution.
And while an AI composition might be convincing enough to act as a bed of music in a computer game or film, it's not quite sophisticated enough to craft a Grammy award-winning song, yet. This is Welcome to the New World by American artist Taryn Southern. It's taken from her album I Am AI. It's the first entire album by a solo artist composed and produced with artificial intelligence.
Welcome to the new world.
Thanks to Amper Music.
Taryn, I think, had a very, very smart idea to collaborate with AI in a way that typically hadn't been done before. And to her credit, she came to Amper and said, could I have access to your technology to make music? And we were happy to provide it. But we weren't there tweaking and directing and producing the music. It was really her creative endeavor that leveraged new technology that ultimately fueled her success and creativity as an artist. And what I think is powerful is that that is just one example of how technology enables people to express themselves creatively through music, whether you're musical or not musical. And when you multiply that by billions of people around the world, I think you get a really, really powerful revolution in creative expression in music.
Soon, everyone will be able to make music just by clicking a few buttons. But there's a problem.
There's too much music, and there already was too much music being made before the internet, before all these new sort of computer-driven ways of making music at home.
Simon Reynolds is a music journalist and author of Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past.
There's a lot of pretty interesting, polished-sounding, well-made music out there, and how do you as a consumer find what's really special? You know, you listen to a lot of things just once, you know, and perhaps never get to the second time of listening to them. I use this term, the DIY-stopia, like the do-it-yourself, the DIY dystopia. It sounds like a fantastic thing, doesn't it? You know, anyone can make music and get it out there. But for the artists, the problem is, how do I grab attention for myself? For the listeners, it's how do I process all this pretty good music? It gets quite wearing, I find, being a music fan. A lot of work and a lot of sifting and processing of stuff.
In this age of streaming, where we have access to millions of songs at the touch of a button, it's not just causing problems for the listeners, but the artists too. Justin Patterson.
Will we generate any new genres? David Bowie was worried about this. He suggested that each decade, each rock and roll decade, if you like, had figureheads. He mentioned the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, etc. Of course, once you get too close to a given timestamp, he was talking in 99, then it's very hard to see objectively who emerged as the figurehead when it's not that long ago. For instance, now we could look at the 90s and say, oh, well, that was the time of Oasis, for instance. We seem to have wave after wave of doing the 80s sound again or the 70s sound again. There's not many new things popping up. We seem to have an increasingly let's reinvent or let's fuse two things together kind of approach.
New musicians are kind of overloaded by influences. They've heard everything. They've heard too much. The temptation, I think, is that they make these sort of eclectic mosaics out of things from the past, and they don't have that sort of drive to do new things. You know, it becomes almost a game of spot the reference. So that drum sound is a sort of mid-80s drum sound that you might have heard on a Fleetwood record. Oh, you know, this other element is drawing on African pop music of the 70s. It's almost like the listener enjoyment is bound up with breaking things down into their constituent parts. And people can do it very creatively. You know, groups like Vampire Weekend have done wonderful little mosaics of these past sounds, but that sort of sense of being shocked by something that you'd never heard before becomes much more infrequent.
But not all contemporary musicians are just rehashing the past. One young artist who is using old technology to create new sounds is Hannah Peel. Hannah has produced several albums, worked with the likes of Paul Weller, and recently scored the official documentary on Game of Thrones. For her album, Mary Cassio, Hannah decided to marry her two loves, electronic synthesizers and a Colliery brass band.
It seemed like the perfect kind of pair-up, knowing the power of them and playing the trombone and feeling that like low-end kind of overwhelming sense in your gut of something more powerful than just your own person, like a solo part. You know, you're in them amongst 30 people breathing at the same time. You hear the breath, you hear the spit, you hear the page turns. And that combination of the frequencies, the brass band inhibit, the melancholy kind of mid-range area that really makes you want to sob, with the synthesizers that reach up to the higher frequencies that take you to a different place, and also mixing that with like real low sub end. As an audience member, you get taken completely to a different place. It really starts to tug on your emotions. There's something about analog synthesizers. I mean, even now when they're brand new, there is something really special about the components that is used inside. They almost feel human. It's almost as if you feel that electricity that is going through the instrument and connecting yourself to it. It feels like it's the same as playing a violin. It's the same as playing an acoustic instrument. You start to feel and you start to work with it. It becomes something more human, and things that actually take your mind to a different place.
Perhaps one of the most famous tracks to feature a synthesizer is New Order's Blue Monday. But Hannah's decided to ditch her synths altogether to cover this and many other 80s tracks using just a homemade music box she calls a Rebox.
Tell me how do I feel? Tell me now how do I feel?
It's a programmable music box, and I make the music by scoring first and then hole punching with a kind of small little hole puncher. That paper then feeds through a music box, much like what you would get in the matchstick boxes that you sometimes buy or in a jewellery box. But the prongs, when they hit the holes, they create the notes. But you get this beautiful sense of the paper rolling through it. So it all depends on your hand and the speed of it. And it sounds so basic, but I use sellotape to join the strips of paper together so I can have these long songs. So the first one I tried on there right back in the beginning was Tainted Love, and working off the soft cell version.
Sometimes I feel I've got...
And then that went on to me finding different 80s kind of tracks, mainly because it works so well on the music box. You're kind of stripping out the computer and that mechanical thing and creating something brand new from it. And it was born out of wanting to go against using cables and getting fed up of using cables and electronics.
And I've lost my life.
As well as making albums, Hannah composes music for theatre, TV and films, and is also a part-time radio DJ. But in this digital day and age, it's not unusual for young musicians like Hannah to juggle several gigs at one time. And a big reason for this is a financial one. Justin Patterson again.
The problem with streaming is that the revenue that feeds back into the music industry is very, very slim. If you have a track which is played, streamed 1 million times on Spotify, that makes about $4,000. Now that's not a lot of money for a million streams. So if we take a really, really big song that maybe does 100 million of those, then still that's only like someone's annual salary, one person with a fairly regular job. But there's a lot of people who are involved in the creation of that music. So it's not the sort of revenue that easily props up record companies. It's not the sort of revenue that makes artists rich. It's very interesting that just at the time of the birth of the internet and the birth of Napster in 1999, David Bowie had sold his Future catalogue for £30 million. Now, I think that makes him a very, very astute businessman, because there's no way that as Napster took hold, he was going to make £30 million when all his albums were shared amongst all the kids for free, and then Spotify and Apple Music started selling them and giving him remuneration at 0.006 of a cent per listen. So he really had his finger on the pulse with that one, and I'm sure his children will be very happy with the legacy that I left them.
But as technology takes with one hand, can it give with the other? Some believe the answer to making music financially viable lies within the blockchain. Blockchain is the technology behind digital currencies such as Bitcoin. Sometimes called a digital ledger, it allows information to be distributed but not copied. Once it's stored on the blockchain, it's immutable. But how can this help artists?
The Creative Passport, an identity in a searchable database for music makers to upload and share their information. Everything you'd like to share about you as a music maker.
Imogen Heap's Creative Passport, which harnesses blockchain technology, hopes to give artists personal control over their music and how it generates money.
I got very excited about this technology, blockchain. The reason I got excited was because the music industry is an extremely fragmented space with multiple data sets, missing data sets. The concept of having a shared space to be able to put data together to acknowledge that says this thing about this song, but our data set says this thing about this song. Let's reconcile that and create one identifier for this song so that we don't have to recreate this problem time and time again. You could specify the splits. So I would get the lion's share because I wrote the song and I recorded the song. I would give some money to the other musicians on there. And if this happens, the really exciting thing is that if we have transparency in the value chain, anybody can invest in a music maker, not just a record label. And in time, instead of a record label paying £1 million worth of marketing to create a hit in the United States, you could directly target people who are willing to hear new music by a particular artist that they like, and that they would be paid directly themselves, the listener, to pay to be listened to it. So this idea of the incentive economy, the future of the people-centered internet, reaching out when they're ready to receive information of stuff that's useful to them at the time, then the noise just disappears. And then we just have available great services, great stuff, just getting to who they need to get to when they're ready to receive it.
Blockchain is just one piece of technology that is still in its infancy. as is AI music, and many of the other technologies which have been mentioned in this documentary. But what's undeniable is that in our digital age of rapid innovation, technology is fundamentally changing music in ways that would have been unfathomable even just 20 years ago. So is it even possible to predict what the future holds? Well, let's give it a shot. Drew Silverstein first.
Music will continue to become more and more personalized on a more global scale. As the technology allows for music to be made more efficiently, more reactively, then I think what that means is we are also able to create music more dependent and more specific to individual people. There used to be one version of a hit song that played on the radio. Now there's the radio version, the club version, the online version, whatever it might be. And I could easily see a world where there's not only those three versions, but there's the John version, and there's the Karen version, and there's the Simon version, right? Because we will have the ability to create personalization at a global level, probably change the music industry from what it looks like today.
Justin Patterson.
I think personalization is going to be the big thing. So we will have adaptive music which can react to our geolocation. There's already systems out there. There was an app by the band Massive Attack that remixed differently depending on where you were. There's various emergent systems that will change the music when you turn right or left, so your journey can become something which controls the music. Before long, we're all going to have bots, audiovisual creatures, which represent ourselves and do stuff we don't have time for. When an artist can make such a digital human and present that person on the website, controlled by a bot, just like those things you get at call centres, which are currently rather irritating. But when that thing is quite good, we will be able to have people feeling as if they're interacting with artists. There'll be some very strange conversations, probably quite banal conversations, because they're both working with a bunch of algorithms. But it's going to be quite exciting in that strange new world.
Imogen Heap.
I'm very excited about the future of AI and kind of generative music and how that would make me feel as a creative person. How would I react to a kind of AI version of myself generating music? Somebody could create a songwriting tool, which could be today. The song that is least in existence is around 26 BPM in F sharp, melodic minor. And then I might be like, I'm going to make that song today. I'm going to go and make something that doesn't exist, because you can see where the gaps are. So I'm really excited about that potential future of understanding the landscape and to be able to make something new to bring to that.
Simon Reynolds.
It does feel like we're overdue a new kind of invention, a new kind of machine that will have drastic effects on music in the same way that the sampler did in the 80s, when people were taking excerpts from earlier records and looping them or doing all kinds of strange things with the archive of popular music. We haven't had a machine as revolutionary as that for a while. It's something that breaks all the rules of previous music. One of the things that's happened a lot with the history of music is that a machine that was invented for one particular purpose is misapplied. It's used in a way that was unintended by the manufacturer. That's what happened with autotune, which was designed originally to be inconspicuous. You weren't supposed to know it was being used. It was supposed to correct errors in singing. And people used it in a very overt way. That created that sort of generation gap, future shock feeling. So someone like the rapper Future, he's almost like a modern day blues singer. It's very, very dark and gritty and raw, even though it's a technology that's usually used to make things sound all kind of shiny and perfect and slick. He has used it in a completely different way.
Perhaps Justin Patterson's latest project will be just the invention to help propel music into a different dimension.
I'm currently involved in starting a new project called Happy, Haptic Authoring Pipeline for the Production of Immersive Experiences. What I'm going to be doing is producing a music production tool for the music producer in the studio. It will be in mixed reality, so instead of a virtual environment, The music producer will see their familiar computer or recording studio. But instead of having to touch a whole bunch of knobs and buttons in that studio, the producer will be presented with a blob which is superimposed on their field of vision. And that blob will be a representation of sound. And the producer will be able to touch that blob, and by stretching it or touching it, prodding it, manipulating it, just as if it's a lump of plasticine, if you like, blue tack, then they will be able to change the sound. This should do two things. One, it will allow a greatly simplified experience for interacting with some complex music production parameters. That means it will be easier for people who are less versed in the complex procedures of the recording studio, but it will also mean that the professional user can achieve the same results but much faster than engaging with a whole bunch of physical controls as they have to at present. Happy, you heard it here.
Whatever role technology will play in the creation of music in the future, for Simon Reynolds, it will always have to perform one crucial task.
Despite, you know, having all these newfangled things to play with, at the basis of music is still the same emotions, you know, loneliness, lust, longing, love, despair, boredom. You know, these are the fundamental grammar of emotions that human beings are dealing with, and young people in particular feel intensely. That's what people are trying to express. It's just the tools to express it with change.
Stanford professor Ger Wang.
In a way, it goes back to Marshall McLuhan when he said the medium is the message. Now, what he really means in this context, in a way, the medium in its ability to shift and change society in people's way of life, it far exceeds the message. We're in a time right now and moving forward where it's not only we're trying to find answers, we're actually trying to figure out what the right questions are in the first place. And so technology in the musical context is actually posing in wonderful and possibly wonderfully problematic ways of asking us, you know, what do we want from music? I don't expect we'll have a clear or agreed upon answer to that question, but I think maybe the questions will become better and more articulated as we continue to work with new technology for music, but also for everything else in our lives.
I've got a bike, you can ride it if you like it. Got a basket, a bell that rings and things to make it look good.
In 1967, when we recorded our first album, The Piper of the Gates of Dawn, the advent of the digital era was still a long way away, and we had access to a relatively small audio toolbox. Over 50 years later, it's remarkable how the home computer has replaced expensive studios. But then when I listen back to tracks from that era, I can't help but marvel at the quality. As good as something recorded today. And that's a testament to the many amazing engineers that we worked with. In the future, will we see the death of traditional instruments? Personally, I don't think so. I regularly meet kids who are learning to play drums and guitars, often by studying their favourite songs from the 60s and 70s. My great worry is we have returned to the dark ages in terms of opportunity for young musicians to make a living from their craft. Whether technology can help, as Imogen Heap believes, remains to be seen. I truly hope so. Also, many fear that technology, once something that facilitated the creative process, is now ultimately driving it. I firmly believe that it's still just a tool, not a creator. Of course, it's impossible to predict what will happen in the next 50 years. But I still think, and hope, we're a long way off from a machine doing better than the Beatles, Hendrix, Bob Dylan, or, dare I say it, Pink Floyd. Thanks for listening to A History of Music and Technology with me, Nick Mason. The programme was mixed by James Beard and produced by Craig Smith. The editor is Jesper Corbett. It was made in association with the Open University.